So we're looking this morning then at that passage that I read a few minutes ago, John chapter 18, verses 28 to 38. During the next few weeks, all over the world, people will be huddling around TV screens to watch a ball being kicked around a stretch of grass. Here in England, the viewers will be wearing white and shouting, "Go on, Harry Kane." In Wales, they'll be wearing red and shouting, "Go on, Gareth Bale." In Argentina, they'll be wearing blue and white and shouting, "Go on, Messi." And if you were to approach then any of these people and ask, "Why are you doing that?" the reply would come back something like, "We're supporting our nation. That is why we're doing it." It's because it's a feature of us human beings that we all have a national identity. We all have a nation. And Jesus, being authentically human, was no different. He had a nation. In verse 35 of our passage this morning, someone is speaking to Jesus and says the words, "Your own nation." And that is not an inappropriate phrase to use. It's not crass and out of place. It's reasonable to speak to Jesus of his nation. He doesn't exist in a state of ethnic detachment, rootless and neutral. No, Jesus is unambiguously Jewish to no less a degree than Peter or John or Martha or Mary. He looks Jewish. He sounds Jewish. His way of thinking is Jewish. His cultural proclivities are Jewish. That is his national identity. From head to foot, we might say, Jesus is Jewish. And against that backdrop then, that backdrop of Jesus' Jewishness, our passage highlights two realities that are really rather striking. And here's the first. Jesus does not die a Jewish death. That's the first thing I want us to consider. Jesus does not die a Jewish death. And it's verses 28 to 32 that I'm interested in at this point, and we'll spend longer on this first part of the sermon. And what we have there in those verses is an almost comical altercation between the Jewish leaders and the Roman governor, Pilate. It feels almost like a tennis match as they exchange incivilities back and forth, back and forth. It begins with the Jewish leaders refusing to cross the Roman governor's doorstep. Verse 28, by the way, their rationale for that, so that they would not be defiled but could eat the Passover, exhibits the most colossal confusion, doesn't it? Moral confusion on the one hand, because the one thing that they are emphatically not doing this Friday morning as they endeavor to get the Holy Son of God crucified is keeping themselves undefiled. No one ever defiled themselves more than these men on this day. And theological confusion on the other hand, obsessed with the Passover ritual, eating that sacrificial lamb at just the right time and in just the right way, and yet stupidly unaware its whole purpose was to point forward to the real Lamb of God whose sacrifice was unfolding right there, right in front of them, right before their very eyes. So as I say, they're deeply confused. But anyway, the point is that they cannot countenance crossing Pilate's doorstep, a fact which causes Pilate a degree of inconvenience. He has to go outside to them, verse 29, not the kind of thing a proud, self-important governor exactly relishes. And I think it's because this inconvenience has irritated him that he asks the Jewish leaders that question, verse 29, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" It might seem to us a very reasonable question for him to ask. Surely he's just fulfilling his role of judge and inviting the prosecution to make its case against Jesus. But remember that Pilate has already provided a band of soldiers, verse 12 of this chapter, to help the Jewish leaders arrest Jesus, which suggests that at that point, he was happy to cooperate with their schemes. He wasn't concerned about proper judicial processes then. He wasn't concerned to apply the brakes to the Jewish leaders' bloodthirsty conspiracy. It was rather, "You want to get rid of Jesus? No problem. Here are a bunch of my soldiers at your disposal. In other words, as he begins now in verse 29, a proper formal tribunal, let the prosecution bring their accusations, it represents a U-turn in his approach. It's Pilate suddenly refusing, after all, to just go along with whatever the Jewish leaders want to do with Jesus. And I'm saying it reflects his annoyance that they won't enter his building, that he has to go outside to them at this chilly early hour of the morning. If you're going to cause me hassle like that, you Jewish leaders, then I'm not going to play ball anymore. I'm not going to fast-track Jesus to his execution as I was originally going to do for you. And it's that U-turn from Pilate which prompts then the Jewish leader's prickly response in verse 30. If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you. Perhaps you've had that experience of going to the doctor's and you sit down and the doctor shuts the door and sits down opposite you. And the first question is, how are you today? And the silliness of that question fleetingly tempts you to respond, well, what do you think, doctor? If I was in tip-top condition, then I wouldn't be coming here to see you. But of course, you have manners, and so you don't get sarcastic like that. But these Jewish leaders get sarcastic like that here. Do you think we've hauled this man before the most senior Roman official in the land at an unearthly hour of the morning because we've just found him walking along the street minding his own business somewhere? That's what they're saying. There's real attitude, as we would say, in their words, because they're miffed that Pilate has changed his tune. Don Carson comments, they had been encouraged to think that he would ratify the proceedings of the Sanhedrin and get on to other business. To find him opening up what was in fact a new trial made them sullen, hence their terse remark. Now, if your manners at that doctor's surgery did momentarily desert you and you articulated that thought in your head, you probably wouldn't thereby charm the doctor and make him really want to help you, would you? And the Jewish leader's biting sarcasm doesn't charm Pilate and make him really want to help them. He responds by digging his heels in even further. Okay, guys, if you're not happy with the way I'm going about this, I've got a suggestion for you. You can leave me alone to get on with more important matters while you go off and carry out your own legal proceedings. Take him, verse 31. Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. And so you see what I mean, I hope then, about this Wimbledon-like exchange that's going on here. The Jewish leaders and the Roman governor equally belligerent, as it were, whacking the ball to and fro into each other's court in this ongoing ding-dong, this ongoing altercation. But the second half of verse 31 is interesting. There's the opportunity there for the Jewish leaders to go for the decisive, satisfying smash, to continue the tennis analogy. Go and try Jesus yourselves, Pilate has just said to them. And they could reply, okay, you stupid Roman governor, we'll just do that. You're a waste of space, man. We'll go and sort this case out ourselves. That would have been the defiant, point-scoring response in keeping with the tone of the conversation so far. But suddenly notice they draw back. There's a sudden, panicked de-escalation on their part. It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death. It's pathetically anticlimactic. Effectively, oh no, Pilate, please don't send us away. Open a proper formal trial if you must. We need you if Jesus is going to be put to death. Now, strictly speaking, it's probably true that the Jewish leaders have no legal powers to execute Jesus. And you can kind of see then why they suddenly panic here and are prepared to lose the argument and look silly rather than have Pilate send them away. Except that there have been previous occasions when they did try to kill Jesus themselves. Chapter 8, verse 59 of this gospel. They picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself. Chapter 10, verse 31, the Jews picked up stones again to stone him. They weren't concerned in those moments about their restricted legal powers. Those passages suggest that if they really wanted to, the Jewish leaders could turn their backs on Pilate this Friday morning and carry out the killing of Jesus themselves. And that, as I say, would be a much prouder outcome for them than this embarrassing capitulation to Pilate in the second half of verse 31. So why don't they? Why don't they? Well, John explains, doesn't he, in verse 32. And fascinatingly, his explanation has nothing to do with the psychology of those Jewish leaders. What is going on in their heads suddenly fades from view and becomes utterly irrelevant. The crucial point, John says, is that Jesus has spoken a word. And Jesus' word must be fulfilled, end of. What word? Well, John is clearly referring back to chapter 12, verse 32. Where Jesus had announced that he would be lifted up from the earth. Lifted up from the earth. And John had commented then in the next verse of John 12. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. The exact words John now repeats here in chapter 18, verse 32. So as I say, that's clearly what he's talking about. Jesus' word there in chapter 12 that he would die by being lifted up. And of course, dying by being lifted up means one thing: crucifixion. So Jesus had foretold that he would be crucified. And that's why these Jewish leaders can't say, "Stuff you, Pilate," and go off and kill Jesus themselves. Because if they had done that, it would not have been by crucifixion that Jesus would have died. Those Jews, they could get away with a low-key stoning of somebody in a Jerusalem back alley. They could get that over and done with quickly before the Roman authorities even realized that anything was happening. But they couldn't erect a huge cross somewhere in Jerusalem and crucify someone. They couldn't do that in a quick and surreptitious fashion. No, only the Romans could crucify. That was their thing. And so if Jesus had foretold that he would die by being lifted up, he must die a Roman death, not a Jewish death. These Jewish leaders, of course, don't know that their actions here in this encounter with Pilate are being dictated by what Jesus had earlier announced. But they are. They capitulate to Pilate and don't take matters into their own hands in order to fulfill the word of Jesus that he would die by being lifted up. All of which raises the question, why had Jesus foretold that kind of death anyway? Why did the precise manner of his death matter? Why is it so important that he be lifted up specifically? Well, that question may be answered in different ways from the Bible as a whole, but a reading of John's Gospel reveals one answer that's particularly important to this particular author. Jesus' death fulfilled certain Old Testament types, as we often call them. It fulfilled certain Old Testament pictures. One of those I mentioned earlier in passing, the Passover lamb. Jesus' death fulfilled that type. But that didn't necessitate him being lifted up. Being lifted up wasn't part of the whole Passover thing. However, another Old Testament picture did involve a lifting up. Some of you will already know, I'm sure, what I'm talking about. Do you remember Jesus' words in chapter 3, verse 14 of this gospel? As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. He's alluding, of course, to a historical incident recorded in Numbers chapter 21. The Israelites are in the wilderness. They grumble against God and against Moses, the account says. Why have you brought us into this wilderness where there's no food and no water in order to die? And as a result of their grumbling, God sends fiery serpents among the Israelites, and they bite many Israelites, and those who are bitten die of the bites. But then God tells Moses to do something to address to resolve the situation. He's to make a fiery serpent, and he's to put it on a pole. And that fiery serpent on the pole will bring healing to those who have been bitten. And Jesus' death, then, it fulfilled that type too. Not just the Passover lamb, but the bronze serpent. And so, like it, he had to be lifted up. Which raises the further question, what does that type, that Old Testament picture, contribute to our understanding of Jesus' death? That's an important question to ask, by the way, of all the Old Testament types and pictures of Jesus. There's a crucial text in 1 Peter chapter 1. I think Mike's been preaching from these scriptures recently. 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 12. Peter is talking about Old Testament prophecies of Christ. So just that whole motif, really, of the Old Testament looking forward to Christ's sufferings and glories. And he says in verse 12, it was revealed to them, that's to those Old Testament characters, that they were serving not themselves, but you. Now that's very interesting. So the purpose of the Old Testament prophecies and types, the purpose of the Passover, the purpose of the bronze serpents, the purpose of the sacrifices going on in the temple all the time, was not really, not primarily, so that the Israelites could see Christ kind of anticipated in those things and believe in Christ. That was one purpose. But Peter says, actually, primarily, they weren't serving their own generation. They were serving you, you new covenant believers. So that you who have seen the cross of Jesus can have further light shed on what the cross of Jesus means by going back to the old covenant types and pictures. That's the fascinating logic that Peter is expressing there in 1 Peter 1, verse 12. So it's a very important question then. Well, what does each of these types contribute? What does the bronze serpent contribute to our understanding of Jesus' death? The Passover lamb, it contributes by magnificently highlighting the concept of substitution, doesn't it? It's so obvious, so gloriously obvious, that the Israelites' firstborn should die, just like the Egyptians' firstborn, but the lamb dies instead. The blood of the lamb substitutes for the blood of the firstborn sons. What about the bronze serpent? What does it contribute to our understanding of Jesus' death? Well, it highlights the concept of looking. To benefit from the bronze serpent, what do the Israelites in the wilderness have to do? What do they have to bring to that bronze serpent in order to benefit from it? Some form of penance for all this grumbling that they've engaged in? Some polished speech that they have to eloquently read out, expressing their profound contrition? Do they have to perhaps climb up the pole and touch the bronze serpent, so that at least it costs them a bit of effort, a bit of blood, sweat, and tears? No. They just have to look. Just look. That's all. And this, then, is how the bronze serpent type contributes to our understanding of Jesus' death. It points us to how we go about benefiting from that, from Jesus' death. We look. We look. Maybe this morning you're very conscious of all the mess that you've made of your life. All the stupid, wrong things that you have done. The way that you have not just broken but utterly trampled upon God's standards and requirements. And you hear this Christian message, this Christian gospel being preached, and you think to yourself, well, I'm just too bad. Too messed up. I'm too bad to avail myself of Jesus' death. I have nothing to bring to it. No goodness. No decency. Nothing to at least partially compensate for the mess that I've made of my life. And I'm saying to you this morning, you don't need to bring anything. Just look. Just look. I mean, anyone can look, can't they? You might be penniless and have no prospect of ever driving a Lamborghini. But as you go past the showroom at Silverlink or somewhere, you can look longingly at one. You might be overweight and unfit and have no prospect of ever running out of the tunnel into a packed stadium with three lions on your shirt. But as the TV cameras capture Harry Kane and co. doing that over the next few weeks, you can look longingly. Looking longingly, I'm saying, is free and it's effortless. The penniless can do it. The overweight and unfit can do it. And when it comes to Jesus' death, the sin-laden and the guilt-ridden can do it. You can do it. You can look longingly at Jesus' death. You might not be able to do anything else, but you can at least do that. And that's enough, the gospel says. All the fitness he requireth is to feel your need of him. It's all that Calvary's cross requires of you this morning. Just a helpless, self-despairing, longing look. Jesus, I need your death to save me from hell. Jesus, I want your death to save me from hell. And that longing look will bring cascading down upon you an avalanche of forgiveness and cleansing and salvation. That's all it's takes. That's why Jesus had to be lifted up to fulfill the type of the bronze serpent, which tells us you come to the cross empty-handed and you receive everything by the grace of God. Jesus does not die a Jewish death. But then secondly, and much more briefly, Jesus does not establish a Jewish kingdom. Jesus does not establish a Jewish kingdom. And this then is verses 33 to 38. You see, Pilate assumes that that is exactly what Jesus is about, establishing a Jewish kingdom. There may have been a couple of reasons for that assumption. For one thing, revolutionary Jewish nationalism was not uncommon. Pilate would have dealt before with men attempting to establish a Jewish kingdom. Indeed, just beyond our passage, just beyond where we stopped reading this morning, we have that man Barabbas mentioned, and that's exactly what he was all about, establishing a Jewish kingdom. And then for another thing, when securing from Pilate that band of soldiers that I mentioned earlier to go and arrest Jesus in the garden, the Jewish leaders had probably already played this card with Pilate. Oh, that Jesus, you know, you need him arrested. He's a revolutionary. He wants to overthrow the empire. Yeah. They'll certainly play that card a bit later on, and they've probably already played it. And so these are probably two of the reasons why Pilate makes this assumption. And it's this assumption then that his two questions in verse 35 are coming from. First of all, am I a Jew? He asks. So there, he's responding, you see, indignantly to Jesus' suggestion in the previous verse, verse 34, that Pilate might himself be feeling some kind of draw, some kind of attraction toward Jesus' kingship. That's what Jesus is suggesting. Do you say this of your own accord, Pilate? Jesus is probing there. Is there something inside you, Pilate, that's actually drawn toward me and becoming my subject? And there isn't. And that's what Pilate is bristling at in verse 35. And he's saying, why on earth would I, a Roman governor, join a movement that's all about overthrowing the Romans and restoring Israel? Am I a Jew? And then his second question, what have you done? You see, Barabbas had advanced the nationalistic cause through murderous actions. We know that from Luke 23, verse 19. That's how revolutionaries operate. That's how they operated in that context. They advanced their cause by shedding blood. And so Pilate thinks Jesus might be a revolutionary. And so he's asking, what atrocities have you committed then? So that's his assumption. And in verses 36 and 37, Jesus corrects Pilate's misunderstanding that he's establishing a Jewish kingdom. And he does so addressing both of the two questions. Let's deal with them in reverse order as we close. So first of all, the question, what have you done? Pilate, as I said just now, he's asking Jesus, how have you won these followers of yours? My people were there a week ago and saw your entry into this city and all the crowds and how they were throwing down palm branches, shouting Hosanna. How have you won their allegiance, Jesus? What kind of violent, bloody antics have you had to perform to capture their hearts? And notice then in verse 37, Jesus says to Pilate, you say that I am a king. So he's saying there, yeah, you're right, I am a king. And then he continues, for this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I've come into the world. And the ESV is right to have a bit of a dramatic pause there with that dash there. And how does he go on then? For this purpose I was born, for this purpose I've come into the world, to fight and kill and do whatever it takes to restore the glory of Israel. No. To bear witness to the truth. Now again, we need to set that, a bit like the phrase lifted up, we need to set that within the context of John's Gospel as a whole, where two things are clear. Number one, the truth in John's Gospel, and it's used often, that kind of language, truth, true. The truth in John's Gospel is God himself. He who sent me is true, Jesus says a couple of times, chapter 7, verse 28, chapter 8, verse 26. Or remember in his prayer in the previous chapter, chapter 17. Verse 3, the only true God, he refers to God as. So the truth is God himself, that's point number one. Point number two, Jesus bears witness to the truth, John's Gospel makes clear, not because he's some great theologian or something and just has a massive brain and understands a lot about God, but because he is the truth. One of the most famous verses, chapter 14, verse 6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That is to say, he is God himself in the flesh. And so Jesus is saying, you see, this is my answer to your question, Pilate. What have you done? What have you been up to? This is what I've done, Pilate. This is how I've won followers. Not by rampaging around the place as some kind of terrorist. No, the thing about me that captures people and turns their lives utterly upside down is that in me they encounter ultimate reality. In me they come face to face with the one whose handiwork they see on a dark night when they look into the skies and they see the galaxies. In me they see the God who made everything. And that inner restlessness which is there in every human being, because man is restless till he finds his rest in the God who made him for himself, that inner restlessness, which has not been stilled by any amount of pursuing money, any amount of pursuing sex, any amount of pursuing fame. That inner restlessness has been stilled as they've come face to face with God in me. That's what Jesus is saying. That's how I've won people. That's the effect I've had on people. They've been brought to their knees before me because they've recognized in me the living and the true God. So that's how he answers the question, what have you done? What about the question, am I a Jew? Pilate is asking, why would I be interested in joining a Jewish kingdom? But you see, if it isn't, if Jesus' kingdom isn't a kingdom of hot-blooded revolutionary Jews, but if it's a kingdom for those who want to meet and know the true and living God, then it's irrelevant that Pilate is not a Jew. And so Jesus says at the end of verse 37, everyone, that's the key word, everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. regardless of ethnicity, regardless of nationality. That's irrelevant. Everyone who wants to meet and know the true and living God, they come into my kingdom. And so I want to close then, challenging you this morning. There is a kingdom that is not from this world, and we should translate it from what Jesus says twice there in verse 36. He's not saying there that his kingdom has nothing to do with this world, that it's some kind of ethereal thing. No, his kingdom is in the world, and it's growing, and it's spreading throughout the world, and it's taking over the world. But it's not from this world in its origin. Its origin lies in heaven, not in any nation, in any country of this world. So it's not a Jewish kingdom, it's not a European kingdom, it's not a British kingdom. It's a kingdom whose origin lies in heaven. And the king in this kingdom is Jesus Christ. And he is calling upon all human beings from every nation and tribe and people and language to come and bow to him and come into his kingdom. And he promises many things to those who do so. And perhaps the most glorious promise of all is this. He promises that if you come, then in me, you will encounter the living and the true God. That which everything in your God-created soul yearns for and is wired for and is restless for and is pining for, you will encounter it. You can't encounter it anywhere else, but you will encounter it if you come into my kingdom and bow to my kingship. In me, God in the flesh, you will encounter the living God. And so my question is, will you come? Will you quit seeking God in all the wrong places? All the religions, all the philosophies, all the idols of our Western civilization. Quit seeking God where God cannot be found. Come to Jesus Christ. He's God. He is the truth. He bears witness to the truth because he is the truth. In him we encounter God himself. Pilate wouldn't come. That contemptuous question at the end of our passage, what is true? Who's this God? Will you come? Will you come this morning? What a tremendous thing it is to be able to say those words with which our same author closes his first letter, 1 John chapter 5, verse 20. We know that the Son of God has come and has given us understanding. That's what Christians can say. Those who have come into the kingdom of Jesus Christ can say, he has given us understanding so that, John continues, we may know him who is true. That's what it is to be a Christian. You've been given understanding through meeting Jesus of the God who is true. And that can be your experience. Come to King Jesus. Amen.